Yeah. So I don't know. Anyhow, let's get this show on the road. Are you ready? Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Vestai Vampyr and Jajim Tai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome, warriors, to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
And today we are looking at the second book of the IKS Gorkon series called Honor Bound by Keith R.A. DeCanido, published in December of 2003. So, John, what does it say on the back of the book for this one?
The Order of the Bat'leth, founded after Kalis's ascension to Stovakor, was tasked with rooting out dishonorable behavior and spreading the word of Kalis to the Klingon people.
Ding dong. Have you heard the word of Kalis today?
Get out of here.
In the subsequent millennium, the Order has become more ceremonial, but now Chancellor Martok has called the Order back to its original function, to preserve the cause of honor. Captain Clegg of the IKS Gorkon, the newest inductee into the Order, has given his word to the children of Santara that the Klingon Empire will leave them in peace. But Clegg's old rival, General Talak, has ordered him to go back on his word and aid Talak in conquering the Santara's world. Now Clegg must stand against his fellow Klingons, but will even his fellow members of the Order of the Bat'leth, not to mention his own crew, follow him into disobedience, or will they betray him to Talak? The crew of the Gorkon faces its greatest trial in a glorious adventure that will be remembered in song and story throughout the Empire.
Excellent. So, yes, it was interesting how you spreading the word of Kalis and how you went through that. You know, just as an aside, when I'm at conventions, I'm always tempted to ask prospective new members as they walk by, have you accepted Kalis as your Lord and Savior?
I think that would be a great panel or great in-between panels activities for a lot of conventions. It would give those people who have studied the ways of honor, the ways of Kalis, a chance of preaching the words of Kalis or just discussing the views of honor that have been promulgated by Klingon culture.
Yes, but now we digress. Let's get back on track here. So let's go into overall impressions. I'll go first this time. This is a continuation of what is turning out to be an epic story. And it has, in this particular volume, it has an Arthurian kind of feel to it, where Clegg is stuck out there, he's under orders to do something and go against his own sense of honor, but he calls for help. And I didn't know that the Order of the Bat'leth was kind of like this. They're kind of like knights. They stick together and they come to each other's aid for the most part when they need to, and their pin is actually a communication device that goes only to other members of the Order. And so that's where I get the Arthurian feel with this. I like the way that Clegg, if you changed points of view in this story, and if you looked at it through Talak's eyes, Clegg would be a villain. Clegg would be the bad guy. He is not following the rules as far as Clag is, or as far as Talak is concerned. But I like the way that Keith has taken this and given it to us from Clag's point of view, where Clag made a promise to these people and he is going to actually go into battle against other Klingons to preserve his word that he is actually authorized to give as a captain of a ship. So I just really think it's a great story, a really good point of view, craftily written, and I can't wait to read the next one.
Well, in any well-written villain, any well-thought-out villain in any story, it should be almost interchangeable as to who the story is told by. And their motives should be logical, complete, and self-contained, self-sustaining. Because the villain is just the villain because of his point of view versus society's point of view. So you should be able to just turn things around, like Obi-Wan Kenobi said. Yes, he did kill your father from a certain point of view.
Yeah. So what were your overall impressions?
A Good Day to Die set up the moral and physical crisis for this book. It in itself was a good and sustained story and can stand alone. But it was also a good setup for what this book, what Honor Bound, was going to be about. And it takes those themes that you touched on a minute ago and kind of fleshes them out, in so much that not only is Talak a villain here, but he is fighting his own brother too. So there's this house dilemma that's going on between the two of them. Another thing, these two books almost feel like they should have been a single volume, a single story. Both books are slightly shorter than what we normally see in a novel of this time period, in the early 2000s. Both books had a glossary attached to the back of them to kind of pad out the printing. But if you put the two books together into one volume, I think the story would have sustained itself from beginning to end.
Yeah, I agree. It's really neat how, yes, you could read either one of the two books in this series we've read so far, that they are standalone and compact and a story in themselves, but how they also hook together. I agree. If you took the epilogue out of this book, Honor Bound, and clipped it onto the end of the first book, you'd have a long novel, but at the same time, they just dovetail one right on the other because the story just continues very smoothly between the two.
There really is not any time lapse between the two books.
No. Clag leaves to go back to his ship. He lets everybody know that, okay, this is done. We've kept our promise. We're going to move on now. And Talak gets a hold of him and says, oh, no, you're not. You're going to conquer that world or else. And Clag says, well, then I guess we're going to have to get ready to defend my word. And what's really scary about the whole thing is Clag is by himself. There's just the Gorkon, and there are a lot of ships that are going to come and come after him, and he's not going to back down, but he does ask for help, and he gets it.
Of course, remember that while Clag is alone against a fleet, Clag knows about the subspace eddies that are going to cause the unaware fleet a bunch of headaches.
Yes. And he also has a very, very good crew that are able to start figuring things out and how to work around these subspace eddies around Santara to make like the torpedoes work and the phasers work and things like that. There's just one problem with that, and Clag apparently has a spy on board the ship that is also passing this information on to Talak.
And here I thought you were going to say the problem with that is that he has to take a 2x4 up to the head of his chief engineer to get her to do her job.
Well, actually, another character had to do that. I mean, actually threatened her family to get, who is it, Kurak, to do her job. And yeah, she was just dragging her feet the whole time. But
she did not want to be on a starship as an engineer. She wanted to be in a research establishment designing new systems, new ships, new toys to play with.
Yeah, she was only there because she perceived it as a family obligation that somebody be in the Klingon Defense Force.
I don't think she perceived that. I think that's another 2x4 she was beaten up over the head with.
Yeah. We have a lot of dynamics with characters in here too. One thing though, before we move to that, it is very interesting in this story how it seems like Kronos is left out of the picture. Clagg does not appeal to Kronos for help. He doesn't get a hold of Martok and say, hey, you know, Talak's coming to kill me because I made a promise and I'm trying to keep this. And, you know, the Empire is not involved here. This is a conflict between Talak and his brother, which is another whole nother conflict. And then people on his own ship that are wondering, you know, hey, we're not following our orders very well. We have trouble here. Of course, the vast majority of the Klingons on the Gorkon are going to back their captain, but there are a few that are backing away and thinking, maybe this is not such a great idea.
When you have a ship that has a crew to keep it moving forward, to keep it in flight, plus 1,500 soldiers aboard, you got a lot of people to convince you're in the right, and they need to back you.
Well, he's done a pretty good job of that. So we have lots of little nuances going on here. For instance, Rodek, whom we know is Kern, Worf's brother, who was basically mind wiped, and his appearance was changed slightly so that he could continue to build his honor, because he had just completely lost everything as being part of the House of Moak.
And in the first book, he really was dragging his feet on doing anything, listless, unimaginative. And then all of a sudden, in the second book, Honor Bound, he pulls a maneuver out of his hat that we see in the epilogue concerns Worf, because it's a maneuver he pulled as captain of a ship when he was Kern. And Worf begins to worry, is he starting to regain his Kern memory? I hate to throw a spoiler out here, but we're going to see that play itself out in A Burning House 2 books from now.
Kern does regain his memory. So yeah, that is a spoiler alert, but it's an old book, so I think we're allowed. There's a lot of family dynamics going on in this book. We have the conflict between Clagg and Doric. Now, Clagg has had his father's arm grafted onto his shoulder by Borak, and Doric is really upset about this. He doesn't like this idea. He doesn't want it to happen. Didn't want it to happen. And he's holding a grudge against Clagg because Clagg has done this. Now, Clagg tells him, look, I am the head of our house, and you will do as I bid, but Doric's not having any part of this. And he is behaving somewhat dishonorably in that way.
I think the conflict between Clagg and Doric predates the arm thing. And I think the arm is just an excuse for Doric to be more angry with his brother. We see, I can't remember which book it was in, of these two, we saw that there was a bond as children between the two of them they could do anything. They go out on that hunting trip. They're supposed to bring down a small targ, and they bring down a huge beast they shouldn't have been able to. And they keep talking that Clag and Dorak get together, and by God, they can do anything. And then something happens, and a wedge is driven between them, and they never get along again.
Now, another family dynamic that comes up in here involves Wohl. Now, she was not originally Wohl. She had another name, and she had a son. And she actually, when there's a conflict on the planet, she actually faces and gravely injures her son in hand-to-hand battle.
The thing is, she was a lady of one of the houses. She took on a lover who was not of her station. And because she conceived a child, this other thing on, this is the son you're referring to.
Yeah, Kalpok.
She has to give up the child. Her father, the head of the household, has to farm out the child. And she is disgraced, dishonored, discommodated, thrown out of the house. And it's why, instead of being on an officer in the Klingon Defense Force, she is a Brek in the Klingon Defense Force. She has not seen her son, doesn't realize it is her son, until after she has so gravely wounded him that he will die, that she gets the idea this might be her son. In fact, she doesn't know for sure until the doctor does a DNA test to show her that this was her son.
But Kalpok does recognize her as his mother when they are battling.
Okay, I guess I didn't get that, but there's a lot of stuff I don't get when I'm reading through something.
Yeah. Kalpok was a warrior who was down on his spirits, and all he wanted to do was be killed honorably. So he wasn't leaving his guard down. He wasn't doing anything to get himself killed. He was performing as a warrior. He was performing well as a warrior and killing lots of enemies. But he just wanted to die with honor and go to Stovakor and be done with the whole thing, because he had no house, he had no family, he had nothing except himself. And when Wohl came along, he recognized her almost immediately as his mother because of her she had long red hair, and that was his first clue. And then, of course, her forehead ridges and things, he recognized all of this. And he gets killed by his own mother. And then she realizes it, and she's not happy about this at all.
The thing with this household is, after the Wohl was kicked out of the house, was discriminated, after that occurred, the family took up sides in the Klingon Civil War against Martok. And the family was disgraced and thrown out of the Empire, discommodated, and lost all of its positioning and stuff. So, real tragic Klingon-style story here.
Oh, yeah. Well, we get a lot of this throughout the book, how there's so many dynamics with the characters. Cornyn, her problems. Kurak, who it doesn't seem to be a really great first officer. We got Tuck, who is just stepping up like crazy and coming up with all kinds of ideas to make his ship stronger. Rodek, he comes around and finally becomes a warrior instead of just kind of a placeholder, which he has been. He gets out of bed against medical advice and heads to the bridge to cover his position as the chief gunner.
To get there, give them the idea that he had come up with to make things work.
And Tuck had already come up with his idea, though. So,
remember who Tuck is. Yeah, remember, he's that kid from the Next Generation episode where they find the Klingons imprisoned by Romulans on the planet, and he's he discovers his heritage and he's enthralled by it.
Yeah, he really embraces it because, you know, Worf makes it huge and Tok takes it and makes it even bigger.
Worf takes him on a hunt. Tok comes back with the thing they've hunted, skinned, ready to be cooked, singing the praises of the hunt.
Yeah. Oh, he's just absolutely enthralled with his own heritage when he finally gets to learn about it and embraces it.
And feel the fire burning within him.
So we have the people of Santara who are not happy at first when they see Clegg come back, because Clegg has promised he's not going to bother them anymore. And here he comes down and has to inform them that he had to come back, he had to let them know what was coming, and that he was there to support them, which, you know, that had to be a hard thing for Clegg to have to do.
Yeah, it's tough because he had just given his word. He had every intent of keeping that word. And his brother Klingons are going to violate that word. And he's got to come down and tell the people who he's given the word to that his people are not going to honor his word.
Right. Well, and then, you know, there's a matter of Clegg's honor on both sides. It's two sides of the same coin. If Clegg allows the fleet, Talak and the fleet, to come in and mop up and take over, then Clegg's dishonored in the eyes of the Santara, who admire him for his honor. And he would not be honorable after giving his word. And of course, on Talak's side, as far as Clegg is concerned, outside of the personal differences, Clegg has given his word and had no right to do that, as far as Talak is concerned. So no matter which way Clegg turns, he's going to wind up being dishonored, at least at the early moments of this book.
Keep in mind that it is talked about in the book that Clegg is a captain in the Klingon Defense Force. Clegg is a representative of the Empire, and Clegg has every right to give his word. Talak doesn't see Clegg as honorable because of what he did to another member of Talak's household, Captain Kargon, of the IKS PA that Clegg had served on for 10 years as first officer, and was not going to allow Clegg to give his word and have his word honored, because Clegg, even though he was a member of the Order of the Batleth, Clegg was not an honorable Klingon.
No, not in the eyes of Talak. But I mean, you know, if Clegg was dishonorable, he would not have been given command of the ship that he had. I mean, the Gorkon is a huge ship, and it's you know, Negvar class. It's a big ship with a lot of people on it, on a mission, and Clegg is not going to be allowed to exercise all of the rights and privileges of his office.
Step back. If Clegg was not an honorable Klingon, Martok would not have inducted him into the Order of the Batleth.
Absolutely. You know, I have to ask, why is Talak not a member of the Order?
There's a lot of Klingons who are in charge of things that aren't members of the Order. Remember, there was one ship in all these ships where the first officer was a member of the Order, but not the captain.
Yes. So why don't we talk about the Order of the Batleth for just a little bit? He records a message onto the badge for the Order of the Batleth and plugs us into the computer, and it immediately starts sending messages all over the galaxy to people who have been given this honor over all time.
Including Worf.
Including Worf, yes. So we have, like, the first one it goes to is Captain Kavada of the IKS VID, V-I-D-D, and, which does answer Clegg's call and shows up. And that creates a problem on that ship because the first officer thinks that they shouldn't go. So we wind up with a new first officer on that ship. We have other people that are contacted. We get an old retired Klingon who is now farming on the planet, who hears the signal coming in, and he has to actually dig for the amulet in order to plug it into the computer and get the message. And he's like, no, I'm a farmer now. I'm not even going to bother to answer. And Worf gets a message, and of course Worf's going to charge in and do his best to help out, even though he doesn't arrive quite in time.
I think there's a dilemma. Worf has to go through a dilemma because he's a Federation ambassador to Kronos and should not be getting involved in this. And if I remember correctly, he does the next best thing. He's the one that actually goes to Martok and lets Martok know what's going on.
Yeah. So that results in Clegg having an equal force to T'Lak as they meet in orbit above the planet. And then, of course, T'Lak has the T'Lak has the advantage of having a spy on board the Gorkon informing them of all the upgrades and improvements to the weapon systems. And we get quite a battle in space that's actually fought on even footing, and the Gorkon and the forces that join him actually win the battle, which is kind of a surprise because Clegg should have been outnumbered and outgunned quite a bit.
Remember, though, Clegg mined the subspace eddy field so that he took out quite a few ships when they first came into the system. But then one of the ships had to eject an exploding warp core, and that just changed the physics of the subspace eddies again.
Yeah, it moved them all over the place, and that was quite a move. That warp core exploding outside the ship. It really threw a monkey wrench into everybody's plan.
People were just beginning to live with the eddies, to be able to fire and maneuver in spite of the eddies, and now they get shuffled.
It's just an epic battle in space all the way around. And then down on the planet is another one. We get a glimpse of Goron, who is still not real happy about losing that contest in the first book of the series.
Wanted to commit suicide because he lost the contest.
Yeah. Well, and that got prevented. However, he gets a real big chance to redeem himself in his own eyes when he takes on 15 warriors from T'Lak's fleet.
And I think most members of his 15th squad have been giving him pep talks, except the one member who's a spy, and encouraging him to be Klingon they knew he could be.
Yeah, and he stepped up big time. I mean, that battle that he fought sounded like he was going down, that he was finished, he was going to die with honor, and he defeated 15 other armed Klingons with no help. I mean, he just did it alone.
Okay, and if we're going to go with the Clegg analogy here, it was 24, wasn't it? 5 minutes and 30. He was 30 that he took on, and they were all Jem'Hadar.
Yeah, Goron. He can't inflate his numbers yet because the battle just happened. Now, if Goron shows up in the next book,
I don't think Goron is a character who's going to inflate the numbers. It's just everybody kept nagging Clegg to tell the story that he was so proud of that he couldn't help himself but make it sound better every time, make it sound new every time.
Yeah.
I think the thing on the surface battles, too, they were very, very important in that because of what the Klingons did, because of what Clegg's crew of fighters did in taking back villages that the invaders had claimed, protecting the villages that the invading Klingons couldn't conquer. It allowed the children of the Santara to see what Klingon honor actually meant to Klingons, more so than when the Klingons had come, than Clagg's crew had come to invade their planet and had gone through the contest. They saw Klingons defending a concept, an honor for them.
I agree. It was a great theme in the book, and that all comes to a head towards the end of the book when we have a contest between the leaders of the two factions. We have Clagg on the one side and T'Lak, and they're going to fight it out in the circle. The same kind of duel that Clagg lost before, but he's not going to lose this time.
Another important point here is, why is the general not up in space? Well, an incident happens and his ship is being crippled, and he beams down with the rest of his troops to go and finish the fight to conquer the planet. That's why he's not in space. That's why he's on the planet, able to accept Clagg's challenge to end this with a duel between the two of them within that circle. This time, though, Clagg doesn't make the mistake of using a Bat'leth because hasn't compensated yet for the new arm, but uses a Mech'leth against T'Lak's Trick'leth and is able to overcome it.
Yeah, I thought that was neat how we had different weapons brought in into the picture rather than just Bat'leths. And the Tik'leth versus the Mech'leth.
I remember some of the details in the fight. I can imagine them because my SCA training has allowed me to know the techniques that need to go into combating a long weapon like the Tik'leth with a short weapon like the Mech'leth.
Well, and the, you know, let's face it, Clagg made a great choice. One arm he has that he works very proficiently with, and the other one not so proficiently because he's still learning how to control his new appendage. A Mech'leth is basically a half a Bat'leth. So you have half as many ways to wield it using half the size. And as we already know, Clagg was very proficient with a Bat'leth when he defeated the 75 Jem'Hadar single-handedly Markan.
I kind of have to disagree with you there. The fact that a Bat'leth is a much larger weapon gives it much more power, and you can rely on the power of the weapon to do what you need to do. A Mech'leth is a much shorter weapon and needs to be wielded in a totally different manner to get the same type of effect as you would get with the longer weapon. It's why when T'Lak is fighting with a Tik'leth, he can use the length of the Tik'leth to get more power into each one of his shots. But Clagg, in using a Mech'leth, can block the Tik'leth right it down to his opponent to take a shot, but that shot's got to be done in a way that generates as much power in that shorter weapon, that lighter weapon, less torque on the weapon, as he would get with the longer weapon that has more torque, more speed that can be built up.
You know way more about using weapons in combat than I do because of your experience, so I defer to your explanation.
I was inducted into the Order of the Aaronfeard within the Kingdom of Kalentir in the SCA, which is a group of fighters that has reached a certain proficiency that they will be called upon to take on minor officer roles, NCO type roles, when we do major battles.
Let's talk a little bit about concepts and themes that we encounter in this volume. Honor versus chain of command.
Honor is what Clag is doing. Chain of command is what Talak is doing. And that's where the two face each other as to which one is right, which one is the way to go. Doric falls into the chain of command under Talak, but you see all these other Order of the Bat'leth inductees coming in and backing the side of honor. Honor, which is most important in Klingon culture.
So let's say we have this situation thrust upon, say, a Federation ship, for instance. Which would win out there? Would, let's say, Picard himself was told to go and take and get resources from a world, and he goes to do this, and the people say, we aren't going to let you do this. Picard says, okay, fine, we're the Federation, we're going to leave, but here comes an admiral saying, no, you will proceed and do this. What is Picard going to do?
That's a tough question, because Picard, of all the Star Trek captains that we've seen so far, except maybe, of course, Kirk and Sulu, is on the side of honor. He has defied the Admiralty in various episodes to get where he's at.
Yeah, and maybe Picard is a bad example. What do you suppose? I would think that a Federation, not Picard himself, but a Federation commander is probably going to follow the chain of command, whether he agrees with what's been told to do. He's just going to follow the chain of command no matter what.
And typically, that's what you see in most of the Star Trek series, except, like I say, for those three particular captains, and maybe you throw in Janeway also. But you even see Sisko following the chain of command when he knows he needs to do something different as the emissary, but he eventually gives in and follows the chain of command, and something bad happens in the story because he didn't follow what he should have followed as being the emissary. He didn't follow the, in this case, path of honor, and things happened badly.
Yeah, with Sisko, though, they always seem to turn out well.
Take a season or two, but...
Yeah.
He has to repair. Not the situation resolves itself well. He has to repair the problems that he caused by staying within the chain of command.
Yes. So we also have officers on the Gorkon that are maybe not towing their load as well as they're supposed to. I'm referring, of course, to Kurak, she doesn't want to be on the ship. She doesn't want to be in the defense force. She has other interests. The only reason she is there is because it is required by her family she be in the defense force, and she can't wait for one of her younger siblings or someone else to come in so she can get out. But, you know, I have to question her honor, because she is not performing at 100% of the way she should be. She's just kind of fudging along and making it through. How should someone like that be treated?
You've just got to give them their job, tell them what you need them to do, and hold them to doing what you need them to do. Like when she was given the task of fixing that particular item in the story, and while she said it was impossible to do, Clag just kept her feet to the fire to get her to do it.
You know, it's really too bad when a commander would have to do that in order to keep things going, because it's a distraction from what the actual goal is. Someone like that, I don't know. It would be difficult to deal with.
She wasn't the only one. Clag had a problem with his number one. He didn't think Corman was up to the job that he had to do. Wasn't doing it well enough. Wasn't doing it with enough, oh, I don't know. Just wasn't up to the challenge of the position that he had, right up until he did the unthinkable and saved the ship.
Yeah, he really stepped up, didn't he?
Right there at the end, yeah. You got the feeling that Clegg was not giving the man enough due for what he do. You know, at least, and Clegg didn't see how well he was working out until, like I said, he took over the piloting station and got them out of danger and died for the effort that he put in.
Yes, he died with honor. As a matter of fact, he was the one who was spurring Kurak to do her job and get things done. And her,
Clegg didn't see that.
Yeah. And her and Leskett actually drink a toast to him because of what he did.
And then, like you said, we mentioned earlier, Rodek finally steps up after he's been injured and kind of saves the day. Not completely saving the day, but he's one of many people that had a hand in saving the day.
You know, we also get a mention in here of Imperial intelligence and who the mole on the Gorkon was gets found out, but it's not the Imperial intelligence officer himself that gets caught. It was someone else who stole the equipment from the Imperial intelligence officer and just started sending messages to Talak about what was happening with the Gorkon to make them able to do battle in those subspace eddies.
And an interesting point about that is the person who was sending the information was a Breck from the 15th squad, and how the hell would he have known all the details of how to modify the disruptors to get them to fire?
Yeah. Well, you know, he's a spy, and he's...
I got the feeling he wasn't a professional spy.
Well, maybe...
An Imperial intelligent agent who was a professional spy wasn't up to the challenge because he allowed his communication equipment to get stolen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he corrects that and takes care of business, and that's the end of the spy on Gorkon's ship, or on the Gorkon, I should say. That was just kind of a little aside thing. There are a lot of little side stories going on in this book that could be developed into other branches.
But that's the genius that Keith brings to them, putting a lot of these little things in. You see the Klingonity, or however you say that word.
Yeah.
he brings in a depth to the culture that you don't really see if it's just a straight-out story.
Most stories that are fleshed out into three novels, you get this really good novel at the beginning and a really good novel at the end, and then in the middle, you just kind of get this thing that plods along and you know, it's actually...
You just get your towers.
Yeah. And you know what? That is not the case with this trilogy that we're in the middle of. This book...
I hate to break this to you, Jim, but this isn't really a trilogy. The next book in the series is going to be a totally different story, removed from the events that happened here. That's what I say. It seems like it was one really long story that got broken in two and had to have the pages padded out to get it to fill a full volume rather than make it a little too long to be printed. When Brandon Sanderson was hired by Robert Jordan to finish his Wheel of Time series, he finished it in one book, but the book was so long, would have been so thick, the binding would not have survived the reader's first read. They had to break it into three volumes.
I see. Well, you know, at any rate, as I was saying, you expect a second book in a trilogy to not be as exciting as this one is. Even it is marketed as a trilogy. The IKS Gorkon series is a three-book series. We are in the second book, and it is the action in this book is ramped up to the max. I mean, right from the start, this book starts out with action, and it runs all the way through to the end.
I think you see that in the movies of Star Trek. In The Wrath of Khan, The Search for Spock, The Voyage Home, no one of those movies can slight the other, is lesser than any of the others. They're all really good stories. And take it a step further, when you go to the original trilogy for Star Wars, the best movie, in fact, the best movie of the entire franchise is The Empire Strikes Back, the middle of the first trilogy.
However, you know, Return of the Jedi has a lot of action on its own, too.
And books, and but like you say, in books, it's almost like the author in a trilogy is trying to connect the first book to the third book with the second book.
Oh, we've encountered that here in the past. So let's talk about the ending. If you haven't read it and you intend to, you might want to tune out for a little bit. In the epilogue, Martok arrives with Worf and
bigger boat.
Yes, and Clagg's action, his promise, is backed up by the Chancellor of the Klingon Empire. So Clagg was right all along to make the promise and keep the promise because he is a ship's captain. And Martok's very happy with the way everything has gone.
But remember, before Martok gets there, Limar, the guy who's in charge of the Children of the Santara, has gone up to Clagg and said, you know, I lost the last challenge, and therefore you won the 3 out of 5. You did not step out of the circle, but while you were lying on the ground, I stepped out of the circle. Because they had seen how honorable Clagg's people were, they wanted to join the Empire. So when Martok got there, he got there to a populace that was ready to receive him.
They subjugate themselves to the Empire. Tok becomes first officer, which I think he's very well earned it. And he's a young first officer.
Probably the youngest in the fleet.
Yeah. And you know, if Keith were continuing to write these Klingon stories, probably a while back, Tok would have made captain of his own ship. And that would have been kind of interesting to see.
Yes, we all mourn for the Captain Worf series of TV shows.
So, and then in conclusion to the whole thing, the Klingon mission continues in a search for
more planets, more resources.
More planets and resources to replace what's been, or to replenish what has been used during the Dominion War.
Yeah, there's always the thing that any empire that is growing has to literally be growing in land area, in resources, and in farming potential. The Roman Empire stopped, and that was one of the reasons for their decline.
Well, the Roman Empire outreached themselves. They didn't take care of the resources close to home. They just exploited, and then they'd go and conquer another place, and then they had to go so far away for resources eventually that they just could not sustain themselves.
You mean that the only way for it to work is the sun could never set on the Roman Empire?
Oh, right. They had to, you know, they had to learn how to conserve and use wisely, and they didn't. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
That doesn't seem like a concept that we even started looking at till the 1960s anywhere in the world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we did a real good job trashing our planet up until we decided in the 60s that, hey, maybe we need to stop doing this because You know what? We don't have anywhere else to go right now.
Yeah, we could have. We should have been on Mars by the 1980s at the latest. NASA had a plan. Mark Rubin, I think his name was, put out a Mars Direct plan to launch ships, unmanned ships, to Mars with supplies, and then 2 years later, launch the men to those locations to set up colonies.
Yeah, but it's going to be a few years before we get to that now, if we ever do.
Oh, we'll get there. It's just, we have to. We have to get there, because if we don't start exploiting our solar system, frankly, the way the Klingon Empire has to expand and exploit other worlds, if we don't start exploiting the solar system, we will not have resources left.
So, your favorite point of plot in this book?
It's pacing. I mean, the pacing of this book is such that it literally just keeps moving. You keep saying to yourself, are they ready for this battle? And then boom, the battle's there and it's over. It just moves.
It does. I liked the nature of the Order of the Bat'leth. I like getting that concept fleshed out and how it became a kind of a more romantic idea. You know, there's chivalry, there is camaraderie there. These people that have been inducted into this order, it's not just a decoration, it is a function.
And it is not the Klingon government. It is a group of people who are brought together to defend Klingon honor and do it with the resources that they've got, not impose it from the government.
That's where I was going. I couldn't have said it better. So, do you have any other closing thoughts on this book?
Read it.
Yeah, well, read the whole series. Read anything you can get your hands on by Keith DeCandido. It is worth the time.
Hey, guys out there, he's even written a book about the Ferengi.
Yes. He understands Klingons.
It's two books together, and his half of it, I believe the title is Ferenginar.
No, but Keith understands Klingons.
Keith understands cultures. Keith, get in there, dig in, find out what's going on, and bring it to life.
I'm not taking anything away from any other authors. I'll tell you what, Dayton Ward, Kevin Dillmore, Mike Jan Friedman, you know, all of those guys are brilliant authors, but Keith just seems to get the Klingon thing.
He gets into the culture. He understands what's going on. He gets a feel for it enough to bring it to life.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll go along with that. He really does bring it to life and makes the people real.
It's those little things. Like, you know, the back history of Leader Vol or, you know, any other character he's got in there. Knowing their back history, knowing events that go on, throwing in little things that happen during the missions that really, really show an understanding of that character.
Yes, a lot of depth, a lot of depth.
Without beating over the head with that depth.
So next month, we are going to be looking at Enemy Territory, also by Keith DeCandido, the third book in the IKS Gorkon series. I'm looking forward to that, and, you know, I read it a few years back, and I don't remember it, so I'm about ready to read it again.
Yeah, I don't remember it either, and I've read it a few years back, even though I did remember a lot of the plotting for these first two books. So I don't know if that says anything or if I've just got another magnificent world to discover coming up in the next month.
Yes. I do recall Keith telling us that the first two books of the IKS Gorkon series sold quite well, but the third one kind of lagged behind the others. So I suppose we can, after we read it, we can comment on that. But for now, I urge you to pass along the word that we can be downloaded from Apple Podcasts. Pass along that we can be downloaded from CAG.org/podcast. Listen to us. Send us your comments, ideas. If you have something you'd like to see us read, a Klingon book that we haven't gotten to yet, we'll be looking for something in a couple of months to continue on with. And if you have a preference, let us know. We'd be glad to read it.
And I urge each and every one of you to take the wisdom of Kalis into your heart. Make it your guiding principles. Spread the word. Redeem the culture. Kapla.
And with that, I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
And join us next time.
Studier of Kalis.
And join us next time for Bound by Honor. Kapla. You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kurg Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!